reading a Diana Wynne Jones novel, and I was so immersed in the story that I didn't even hear her ask the first time around. "So can I have it?" she demanded impatiently, like it was me who was inconveniencing her. I was suspicious of what she meant by "have it," so I said no. It's funny how small moments can ruin everything. Later that afternoon, I was reading on my bunk while Bethy held court in the cabin. She'd gotten this box of tampons from the commissary, and her friends were wetting them in the sink, then launching them at the ceiling and laughing. The tampons were stuck there, 20 feet up, their strings dangling like little mouse tails. When our counselor came in, she took one look at the ceiling and demanded to know who had done it. Bethy blamed me, and her friends backed her up, which was how I got banned from the co-ed rafting trip that weekend. It would have been awful enough to stay behind during one of the few off-grounds trips, but then one of the boys asked where I was, and Bethy told him I hadn't come because I was on my period. According to her, I got super bad ones, really heavy, like ragu. Of course, no one questioned how Bethy, who'd I'd only met last Sunday, knew the intimate details of my menstrual cycle. When the bus came back from the rafting trip, everyone on it called me ragu, even the boys. Especially the boys. No one in my cabin would sit next to me, or swim near me, or use the toilets after me. The girls dumped my shampoo and crammed my bathroom cubby full of sanitary napkins. Whenever I put on my swimsuit, they talked really loudly about how sharks can smell blood. Every time they did it, I'd squeeze my eyes shut and I'd write, "Don't cry," on my leg with my finger like I was casting an invisible "don't cry" spell. I had a camera with me, so I started spending all my time doing photography. I'd sign into the arts and crafts cabin, where they never checked, and then I'd go into the woods. I'd take pictures of birds or spell out words with the rocks and photograph them. So while my cabin was hell, at least I had a sanctuary. And then one day, I felt someone watching me. It was a boy, from 8B, with floppy brown hair and the cool kind of braces, the ones everyone called invisible, even though they were really just clear. He was holding a badminton racket and one of those plastic balls that looks like a snitch, which I guessed was the reason he'd come into the woods. He stood there a minute, where he thought I couldn't see, and then he was gone. I saw him a couple of days later in the same place, and again the day after that, always just for a minute, like a deer pausing in the woods. He never got closer, never said hello. I hoped he wouldn't tell anyone where I was. I didn't want the girls from my cabin to show up and ruin it, and I didn't want those awful boys to come laugh at me. They were always asking really crudely if any girls wanted to go to the Rock with them, which was this urban legend at camp, this hookup spot. I was a little nervous that this boy from the woods knew where I went all day, so one night after dinner, I asked one of the nicer girls in my cabin about him. "Lane Rosen," she said. "He's kind of a nerd." "Why? Do you like him?" "No," I said. "I was just wondering." She'd made it sound threatening, as though I wasn't allowed to like him. And I didn't. I'd only wanted his name. A couple of days later, everyone was swimming in the lake. It was sweltering outside, over 100 degrees, so I'd gone into the water to cool off, even though I usually just watched from my towel. "Stay back!" one of the girls shrieked when I swam too close. "Sharks can smell blood! We're going to die!" her friend added, pretending to be terrified. It was so unfair. I didn't even have my period yet. And then Lane, who was floating on one of those inner tubes nearby, pushed his sunglasses into his hair and sighed. "That's the stupidest thing I've ever heard," he told them. "We're in a lake. There aren't any sharks." After he said that, I thought maybe he wouldn't tell anyone about the woods. I thought maybe he was nice, even though I always saw him with that foul group of boys. I thought maybe he was different. I'd never been so wrong. The next weekend was the lower seniors' dance, and the girls in my cabin wouldn't shut up about it. They practiced their hair and makeup in the bathroom for days. They acted like it was a formal prom, not some lame thing with bug juice and a disco ball and the horrible boys from 7B and 8B. "Has anyone asked you yet?" they'd say, giggling, and then discuss which boys they wanted to make out with. Back home, I went to the K-8 school down the street, so I could walk my little sister. The neighborhood kids who went to the actual middle school called where I went baby school. I hadn't understood what they'd meant until camp, where I suddenly felt years younger than everyone else in my grade. I had lip balm and pastel panties, while they had lace thongs and eyeliner. The night before the dance, this girl Megan from my cabin caught up with me on the way to dinner. "I'm supposed to give you this," she said. It was a note, folded into one of those footballs, with my name on the front in cramped boy's handwriting. I unfolded it. The note asked if I would go to the dance with him, and if yes, he'd pick me up at my cabin. It was signed Lane Rosen from 8B. I couldn't believe it. "Well," Megan asked. "Did you read it?" I asked. "Duh, I don't have to. He likes you. Or maybe he just waited too long, and you are one of the few girls left." I put the note into my pocket, trying not to grin. "And he said to give you these," Megan told me, producing a pair of sunglasses from the pocket of her hoodie. They were Lane's Ray-Bans, the red ones he'd been wearing in the pool. I couldn't believe he remembered. Bethy had accidentally stepped on my sunglasses at the lake the other day and had broken them. Lane had seen, everyone had, and now he wanted me to have his sunglasses. He'd been watching me in the woods because he liked me. Maybe if he thought I was cool, the girls in my cabin would finally leave me alone. The night of the dance, I got ready early and sat on my bed reading while everyone else jostled for the mirror. Finally, the first boy arrived. It was this buzz-haired guy, Zach, who'd asked Bethy. She sashayed off with him, and the rest of the girls rushed to make last-minute touch-ups before their dates arrived. And their dates did, in a trickle, the boys wearing short-sleeved button-ups and khakis and looking underdressed in comparison to the girls in their strapless dresses. I was the last one left, so I took my book out to the porch to wait. I waited a long time, and Lane never came. Just as I was about to go inside, this girl Sarah came back to the cabin. "Note for you," she said, handing me a folded thing with my name scrawled across the front. I tore it open. "Sorry," it said. "Changed my mind. Lane." Something in my face must have given it away. It had been a joke all along. A cruel prank he wanted to play on me to show everyone he wasn't interested in the weird, nerdy girl who kept asking about him. "God, I'm so stupid," I whispered, half forgetting that Sarah was there. Sarah sighed. "Newsflash," she said. "Boys suck. It's why our cabin sticks together. It's like we've known these boys for years, and they're all pigs. Most of them have girlfriends back home." I could feel the tears bubbling up, my chest constricting so tightly that it hurt to breathe. Wordlessly, I turned around and ran back into the cabin, and for the first time that summer, I let myself cry. Standing in Latham's dining hall with him 4 years later had made time melt away. I was back there again, 13 years old and sobbing in my best dress, alone on my bunk with the meanest note a boy had ever written. And I didn't want to be. I'd spent a long time walking away from that summer, that loneliness, that version of myself. And then Lane Rosen had found me by the tray return, and it turned out all the walking I'd done had been in a circle.
Chapter 5. Lane. After dinner, as I walked across the grounds back toward the cottages, I had to admit, Latham was beautiful. The dorms looked like fairy tale ski lodges, and the lake glittered, and the classical revival buildings felt exotically collegiate. Even the stone benches along the pathways were charming. We might have been anywhere. Any place where grades mattered and students had bright futures, instead of, well, I thought Sadie would be happy to see a familiar face, but she'd reacted as though I was a ghost. I suppose the fact that I had almost impaled her with a cafeteria tray hadn't made me particularly endearing. I'd only wanted to say, well, I wasn't sure. It wasn't like I knew her, but I wanted to. Sadie and her friends seemed interesting, and anything was better than sitting at Genevieve's table, which I was starting to suspect was a faction of an overeager prayer group I really didn't want to join. I mean, it's not like you can pray for something to unhappen. I touched my med sensor to the scan pad outside my dorm, but it flashed red and beeped, refusing to open. "Come on," I muttered, scanning again. It stayed locked. I scanned again and again. Still locked. "You've got to be kidding," I cursed, banging my fist against the scan pad. I don't know why, but that stupid red light got to me. I couldn't do anything right. I'd been ditched by my tour guide, and then Sadie couldn't wait to get away from me. I'd failed breakfast, and now I was going to fail the goddamn front door. Suddenly, everything that had happened over the past 24 hours came crashing over me in this horrible wave. I gave the door a frustrated tug, but it was no use. "Dude, calm down, we're locked out," someone said. It was the punk kid from the woods. He was sitting on the porch, his back against the railing, a moleskin notebook propped over one knee. He looked frail and exhausted up close. Not so tough after all. "What?" I asked. "Locked out," he repeated, gesturing toward the crowd of people standing around. I'd been so lost in my own misery that I hadn't realized. No one had gone inside. It looked like half the dorm was congregated around the porch, their expressions ranging from resigned to upset. "What's happening?" I asked. "Fire alarm?" The punk kid snorted. "Someone checked out. They're doing housekeeping." He said it darkly, like he'd deliberately chosen the wrong words. When he realized I didn't get it, he sighed. "You know, cleaning out his room for the next lucky occupant." "Someone died?" "Oh, you get used to it. Just wait until they bring the body out." He nodded toward the front door. I must have looked freaked because he laughed, coughing a little. "Nah, I'm messing with you," he said, and then added, "They have tunnels for that." I didn't know whether I believed him. "So we all have to stand around until his stuff is removed?" I asked.
"Pretty much."
He went back to scribbling in his notebook while I stood there in shock. Someone had died. I mean, I knew it happened at Latham, but I hadn't expected it on my first day. It felt so sudden. Like I was being thrown headfirst into the deep end of tuberculosis before I'd even gotten used to the water. "Who was it?" I asked. "Grant Hardin," a wiry, mustached kid said. "Wasn't at breakfast, went to the medical building, and never came back." I couldn't believe it. Grant. He was supposed to show me around. My tour guide hadn't ditched me. He died. After the nurses led us back into the dorm, I watched in shock as people staked out places in the common lounge, turned on the television, and set up board games like nothing had happened. I went back to my room and collapsed onto my bed, listening to the noises in the hall. The walls of my room felt so close, so claustrophobic, and so thin, like there was nothing between me and the hallway except a flimsy sheet of cardboard, and I had no privacy at all. I was shocked that everyone could bounce back so fast, that Grant's death had been cleared away as quickly as his belongings. All I knew was that I didn't understand Latham, and I wondered if I ever would. "Start as you mean to go on," my father was fond of saying. But I certainly didn't mean for my life at Latham to continue like this. No, not my life, just the next few weeks. Latham was temporary, a vacation, a place to stay while I was contagious so my parents wouldn't get fired and so my mom wouldn't panic every time I coughed. The whole Grant thing was an anomaly, a weird twist in the fabric of the universe. But then, so was my being sick. I'd caught TB somewhere. It was random and unfair, and if I'd just taken Spanish instead of science, volunteered at the clinic on Tuesdays instead of Wednesdays, seen a different movie, taken a different seat, I'd be at home eating pizza for dinner and working on my Stanford application. Thinking of it like that helped. As long as I was here, the plan was not to care, to keep my head down, do my work, and get through it. I didn't need to play nice or to make friends. I needed to stay on track, get better, and go home. I took a couple of deep breaths, which actually sort of hurt, put on some appropriately gloomy music, and started to unpack. My mom had packed my suitcase for me, and even though I'd made pretty specific requests, she'd still grabbed the wrong jeans and like five of these polo shirts I never wear. Instead of my favorite t-shirts, I had a stack of every unwanted Hanukkah gift, my name freshly scrawled across each label for the laundry. Fantastic. I put all of it into the wardrobe, and then I stacked my Harbor coursework, my college guides, and my SAT books on my desk. I tried to unpack slowly, so I could avoid the inevitable phone call home. But calling your parents is just one of those things you can't put off forever. It was 7:30, and they were probably sitting on the sofa grading papers with the news on in the background. I could picture my father with his herbal tea and Chapman sweatshirt, my mother in her purple slippers and reading glasses sipping decaf, the careful way my parents used coasters, as though they were guests in someone else's home and didn't want to offend. They were big believers in routine, in getting things done. "When you feel like quitting, do five more," my dad always said. Most of his catchphrases were motivational insults. I stared dubiously at the ancient landline on my desk, knowing resistance was futile. And then I picked up the thing and dialed. Of course, my mom answered on the second ring, sounding way too concerned. "Lane, sweetie, how are you?" she cooed. I said I was fine, and she plunged on, talking about how Dr. Behrens had uploaded my new x-ray so she and Dad could see it, and how she thought it looked much better than the last one, and my dad agreed. The thought of them staring at a picture of my insides on their iPads was pretty embarrassing, and I tried not to imagine the two of them discussing it over dinner, like they'd done with my SAT scores. There was an awkward silence, where I guessed my mom was waiting for me to say something about my doctor's appointment, but I had no idea what. "How was the drive back?" I asked instead, trying to change the subject. "Oh, fine," Mom said. "Not too much traffic." An uncomfortable pause again. "Hold on, let me get your father," my mom said. "I'll put you on speaker." Then she and my dad took turns asking concerned questions about what I was eating, and if there were enough pillows on my bed because they could always send more, and if I was running a fever, and how I was sleeping, and how were the nurses, and did the doctor say anything at all about how he thought I was doing? It went on forever. "Did you ask your teachers if you can do the AP work you brought with you instead?" my dad asked. I said, glancing at the stack of textbooks and assignments on my desk. It was more like a tower, actually. I'd meant to ask, but I'd been so thrown by everything that I hadn't gotten the chance. "It doesn't matter," my mom said soothingly, and my dad cleared his throat like he disagreed. "I mean it, sweetheart. I don't want you to tire yourself out." "No, I'm sure it's fine," I said. "I'll ask them tomorrow." Then my dad told me to hang in there, bud. And I said, "You too," which was completely the wrong thing, but too late. There was an awkward chorus of "I love yous," and thankfully it was over. I felt entirely removed from my old life in that moment. A million miles from the band posters on my walls and from Loki, my black lab, and from everything that had defined me for so long. My parents never used to worry how I was sleeping or if I wanted more pillows. They never used to tell me not to tire myself out back when I was pulling all-nighters over my physics exams. They'd just ask if I felt prepared, and then, after I got my grade, they'd ask what I could do to improve my score on the next one. I was used to my parents, to our cadence and our lives. I just hadn't realized quite how much my getting sick would turn us into strangers, our usually predictable conversations becoming distant and unfamiliar. I picked up the phone one more time and called Hannah, which was my reward for talking to my parents. Hannah and I had been together for 5 months, since the Model UN trip to San Francisco. The amount of time surprised me. It sounded so significant when, in actuality, we'd barely even started.
Hello?
She said tentatively.
Congratulations, you've won a romantic trip for three to SeaWorld.
I tried to disguise my voice.
Lane?
Yeah, it's me, I said. Sorry about the weird number.
It's fine, although I'm devastated I won't be taking my two favorite lovers to SeaWorld.
Wait, you have more than two?
You don't know me,
Hannah giggled. It felt so good to talk to her, to joke about things that didn't matter. I leaned back in my chair and closed my eyes, for a moment letting myself pretend that I was somewhere, anywhere else.
So what's going on in the Harborverse?
I asked.
Oh, God, everything.
Hannah had this wonderfully energetic voice, which always reminded me of a steam engine barreling full force ahead. So I listened as she talked about the weekly quizzes and AP bio and how freaking unfair it was that six of them got picked at random to count for most of her grade.
If I fail, like, one quiz and then do perfectly on the rest, I'd still get, like, 90%.
It's precarious. I'm going to stress eat an entire pizza over this every Thursday night. I can just tell.
You'll do fine, I said. Maybe,
she sighed.
Except it's on a curve and everyone's fighting for second now that...
She trailed off, embarrassed. Now that I'm out of the picture, I supplied. Hannah didn't say anything. She didn't have to. I'm coming back, you know, I said.
I know, Hannah said quickly. Forget I said anything.
We lapsed into silence for a moment. I wasn't used to talking on the phone. Not with Hannah. We texted, sure. And we stayed on Skype for hours sometimes, leaving it running in the background while we reviewed for exams. But this was different. This wasn't keeping each other company. It was keeping in touch. Being long distance as opposed to past tense.
How is it there? Hannah asked. Really?
Fine.
And you're feeling okay?
She said it in this momish voice, and I shut my eyes a moment, as though that would erase it.
Yeah, I'm great, I said.
There's only four classes. We mostly get to lie in bed and watch movies.
Sounds nice.
Well, I'd say wish you were here, I joked.
Lane, she said tentatively, can I ask you something?
You can ask me anything. Although she hadn't asked me much of anything recently. It was like she was afraid. Afraid of answers she didn't want to hear. That was why she acted so cheerful and talked about her classes, the ones I should be in. It had to be.
You know how I'm applying early action to Stanford?
Almost everyone in our group was applying early action to Stanford, so I said yeah.
I was wondering if you'd read over my admissions essay?
She asked. I didn't say anything. I couldn't say anything.
Just to proofread and see if I'm on the right track, or if it's obvious that I used a thesaurus. That kind of thing. You were always better than me in English, so...
She trailed off, waiting for me to respond.
I knew I was supposed to agree to it, no problem. Because that was what we did, Hannah and me. Back in sophomore year, I'd outscored her on every English quiz, and she'd beaten me on every pre-calc. So it only made sense to partner up in chem. And eventually in other things. I used to joke that we were lab partners in crime. Because instead of staying nemeses, locked in a battle over class rank, we'd become a team fighting to succeed at the same thing.
I just started it, but can I send a draft this weekend?
Sure, I said hollowly. Email it over whenever. My voice caught in my throat, and I started coughing. I pressed the receiver against my jeans so Hannah wouldn't hear how bad it was.
You okay?
She asked. Fine, I said hoarsely.
Promise?
I'm fine, I insisted.
You'll get better soon,
Hannah said, like she had some authority on the matter.
And then everything will go back to normal.
Right, I said. Normal. Except Latham was my normal now, and being healthy, being okay, wouldn't feel normal at all. It would feel incredible.
Chapter 6. Sadie. French was one of the better classes, which wasn't saying much. We had it with Mr. Finnegan, who was about 35 and was married to one of the hall nurses. When I first arrived at Latham, Finnegan had been new and eager and actually sort of good. He'd let us read poetry and listen to French music instead of doing insipid exercises about Janine and Paul going to the store to buy a baguette. But Latham had gotten to him. Too many cross-outs and add-ins on his attendance sheet. Too many kids having coughing fits when he called on them, even though half the time they were faking it because they didn't know the answer. Lately, Finnegan had been sticking to the textbook and had mostly put away his playlists. My friends and I all took French together, which was how we'd met. We were sitting in our usual seats by the windows when Lane walked in. Nick was in the middle of some story about this care package his mother was sending, which promised to be the worst thing in the world. Underpants and caffeine-free tea bags, he predicted, and newspaper clippings about my cousins. And then Lane was there, hovering awkwardly in the doorway, wearing another button-up shirt and cardigan, which shouldn't have annoyed me, but it did. That was our thing, my friends and me. While practically everyone else shuffled around in their sweats, we were the ones who still got dressed in the morning and carried school bags. I knew it was just an illusion of normalcy, but it was our illusion, not Lane's. Mr. Finnegan walked in then, carrying a travel mug of coffee. Watching him take a sip was torturous, since all we got was weak, generic tea. "Un nouvel étudiant," Mr. Finnegan said, spotting Lane. I noticed he didn't comment on the lack of Sheila Valdez, who'd decided to take a sick day that morning and was laid up in the nurse's station, enjoying trashy magazines and a dose of Vicodin. Lane asked where he should sit, but Finnegan shook his head and made him stand up in front of everyone and have a conversation in French. First day torture. I'd hoped Lane would stumble, but he hardly seemed fazed, speaking with Finnegan in rapid, flawless French. God, I hated him. I hated his pretentious button-up and the way he smirked after he answered each question, and Finnegan said, "Bien," because he didn't need any grammar corrections. My French never sounded like that. I had to pause and mentally conjugate each verb, starting with je. Of course, Angela Hunter and her clique of brainless Frenchy girls all stared at him lovingly. They didn't know he was a jerk. They just knew that, with 150 of us at Latham, a new boy had miraculously appeared. A cute boy, who hadn't yet proceeded to pull out a handkerchief and noisily hack up blood. That day, we were working on a unit that was supposed to help us in case we got sick in France. I knew we were just going through the textbook, but it still annoyed me. In the exercises, no one ever had anything worse than flu. It was always a cold, a cough, a headache, something that could be fixed with Tylenol or a bandage. Something you wouldn't really go to the hospital for, particularly in the middle of a European vacation. "I'm going to pair you up," Finnegan said. You'll come to the front of the room and put on a short skit about going to the hospital. One of you will be the patient, and one of you will be the doctor. Let's start with Genevieve and Nikhil. Nikhil, you are the patient. Genevieve, you're the doctor. Nick gave me a look of pure mourning over that one. Genevieve hated us. She said that Nick and I did the devil's bidding, since we ran Latham's black market. We supplied everyone with a liberal sprinkling of booze, junk food, and condoms, sneaking everything in through twice-a-month collections in the woods. We left a list, and our guy got what we wanted, although he charged a fortune. Nick and I didn't really take a cut. It was more about the mischief, about doing something that undermined Latham's system. And so Genevieve, despite having cornered me by the laundry chute last month to order 5 boxes of Milk Duds, was convinced that we needed to get us some Jesus. Nick shuffled to the front of the room, where he melodramatically informed Genevieve that, zut alors, he had a terrible stomach ache. Genevieve, who spoke awful French, asked if it hurt. Yes, because it's a stomach ache, Nick said incredulously, while everyone collapsed into giggles. Shh, Mr. Finnegan warned. Do you eat something? Genevieve asked.
Qu'est-ce que vous avez mangé?
Mr. Finnegan corrected, and Genevieve repeated it in the right tense.
20 hamburgers I found in the trash, Nick said, clutching his stomach in fake agony. Help me, doctor!
And then he very loudly pantomimed throwing up all over the floor.
Ew!
Genevieve screeched, looking to Mr. Finnegan.
Continuez,
Mr. Finnegan instructed. You are pregnant, Genevieve informed Nick, at which point Mr. Finnegan sighed and told them they could sit down. The next few groups weren't nearly as bad. Marina and Charlie had got a lot of laughs after Charlie did a flawless impression of Dr. Behrens and asked her to rate her pain on a scale from 1 to 10. I suppose I knew what was coming, because I didn't even blink when Mr. Finnegan called Lane and Sadie. I'll be the doctor, I said, because there was no way I was letting Lane diagnose me with God knows what in front of everyone. Lane shrugged like he didn't care. His hands were in the pockets of his jeans, and I could see a leather belt peeking out from under the hem of his shirt. Honestly, a belt. At Latham.
Où est-ce que vous avez mal, monsieur?
I asked.
Alors, j'ai toussé depuis une semaine,
said Lane. Ugh, he was being so flowery about it, so show-offy. We could do the whole thing in present tense, but he was conjugating in the passé composé.
Et vous avez de la fièvre aussi?
I asked, a plan beginning to form. Lane confirmed that yes, he coughed and he had a temperature. Have you coughed up any blood? I asked in French. Lane paused, staring at me in panic.
Et voilà,
I said, pointing at his shirt. A spot of blood.
No, no, that's ketchup, Lane said, trying to deny it.
I think I have the flu.
La fumière a déjà fait une radiographie, n'est-ce pas?
I demanded. And Lane, looking resigned, had no choice but to agree that yes, the nurse had taken an X-ray. I pulled an imaginary X-ray out of my notebook and pretended to hold it up to the light, enjoying myself immensely. The whole classroom was silent, waiting.
It's only a little tuberculosis,
I said, somehow keeping a straight face.
Un peu de tuberculose?
Lane repeated, glaring at me. And that was when I did it.
Luckily, monsieur, I said, this is simple to treat with the excellent drugs we have. You are very lucky that you are in France.
That was when Finnegan snapped for us both to sit down. He didn't look happy. Actually, he looked exhausted at the thought of having to deal with me, which was fine. Lane knew better than to mess with me, and I'd put on a fun little performance for the class, so whatever Finnegan did to me now would be entirely worth it.
Sadie, what was that?
Finnegan asked. I read about how they treat tuberculosis in France with medication that worked on the older strains, I said.
Is that true?
Someone asked. Finnegan took off his glasses and polished them on the hem of his shirt. You could feel the discomfort radiating off him.
No,
he said firmly. Not for 2 years. He paused, considering it, and then aloud,
Well, only in desperate cases, when the patient requests it. But it was deemed an extraordinary means of preserving life.
What does that mean? Angela asked. Finnegan sighed. He wasn't getting out of this one easily.
The treatment for the other strains didn't work the same on TDR-TB, he explained. Doctors couldn't figure out why, but too many patients who were given the medication died from it, and a lot of those people might have gotten better on their own or at a sanatorium.
Finnegan glared at me, and I stared back at him defiantly. The room was so quiet that you could hear the maple trees outside the window, their leaves rustling in the breeze.
But it worked on some people, right?
Angela asked.
The odds of dying from the treatment were higher than the odds of being cured by it, Finnegan said. And in those cases where the treatment is worse than the disease, doctors stop offering it.
Like pneumothorax, said Charlie, when doctors collapsed people's lungs.
Sort of, Finnegan allowed.
Doctors collapsed people's lungs?
Genevieve sounded horrified.
Like, inside their bodies?
Finnegan put his glasses back on.
This is a French class, he reminded us.
Inside their bodies?
Genevieve echoed, scandalized.
Enough talk, Finnegan said sternly. Take out your workbooks. Page 43, exercises A and B.
And then, like he'd been doing more and more lately, he left the room. When class was over, I watched Lane approach the teacher's desk.
Excuse me,
he said tentatively.
Monsieur Finnegan? Not now,
Finnegan snapped. He recoiled a bit, the way teachers did sometimes when we got too close and they weren't expecting it. I wondered if Lane noticed.
Sorry,
Lane apologized. He shuffled out of the room looking dejected.
Dude,
Nick whispered, shoving his French exercise book into his bag.
That TB is curable thing was genius.
Thanks, I said.
Too bad it isn't true.
Too bad you're not really pregnant, I shot back. He laughed as he sailed out of there. I was the last one left in the room, and Finnegan didn't even look up from his desk as I slunk out. Whatever. He didn't have to explain all that stuff about the treatment for multi-drug-resistant TB killing people with a TDR strain instead of curing them. He didn't have to tell us that it was a last resort only offered in rare cases. He could have just given me a stupid strike and moved on. He could have yelled at me like a real teacher would have done in a real classroom, like he used to in the beginning when Nick and I did that presentation about the mating habits of ducks. It was his fault for acting like we were actual students and slowly taking it back. Of course, Lane was waiting for me in the hallway. He was actually pacing, and he looked furious.
Sadie,
he said the moment I opened the door. Need something?
You threw the assignment, he accused, on purpose.
I wasn't expecting that, or the way he seemed to mean it. He looked genuinely distraught that we hadn't been the best in the class.
It's not a big deal, I said.
It is to me, Lane fumed. You may not care about your grades, but I do. I can't believe you did that to me on my first day.
I thought yesterday was your first day, I said. Lane glared.
You know what I mean. We failed that exercise, didn't we?
It doesn't matter, I said slowly, wondering why he still didn't get it. None of this is real. The teachers wouldn't dare to give anyone less than an A, so you can stop worrying about your stupid grade, okay? And then I stomped away toward the dining hall, putting enough distance between the two of us that we wouldn't have to wait in line together because I didn't know if I could stand it.
Chapter 7. Lane.
As far as first weeks go, I was pretty sure my first week at Latham contained a record-setting quantity of suck. No matter what I did, I couldn't seem to get it right. Everyone else seemed to know exactly what they were doing and where they were going. Everyone else seemed to have mastered the art of blending in. Except for Sadie and Nick's crowd, who made it their business to stick out. I only had one class with them, so I began to watch for them in the dining hall and around campus. Nick lived on my hall, and Charlie was on the floor below, but I rarely saw either of them in the dorm. My only interaction with Charlie was the frantic ukulele strumming and angry falsetto that occasionally drifted out his window. The four of them spent a lot of time in the woods, slinking off into the birch trees in a way that was almost secretive, with bags over their shoulders that seemed too full to be carrying textbooks. In the dining hall, they created small amounts of havoc with the nutritionist. One afternoon, when a plate of freshly baked cookies was set out, they ate them while waiting in line before their trays could be checked. Which isn't to say that I was overly preoccupied with them. I wasn't. I kept mostly to myself, studying in my room or in the library, which was unexpectedly amazing. A holdover from when Latham was a real boarding school. The selection was largely classics, but the study alcoves were fantastic, and I never saw anyone using them. Everyone else seemed to treat Latham like a vacation. The TV lounge was constantly crammed, and the DVD collection in the library was so heavily checked out that at first, I'd thought it had been removed. Graphic novels, magazines, and popular books they didn't carry in the outdated library were passed around like contraband in the dorms. Board game tournaments took over the common room, with post-it note warnings stuck on top of in-progress games, saving them. The guys on my hall even turned showering into an extracurricular activity, spending so long in there, every night, that it was lights out by the time a stall would open up, the water ice cold and the floor slippery. But the thing about a vacation is that eventually, it has to end. And I wondered why I was the only one who seemed to realize that. While my hallmates played Monopoly in their pajamas, napped during the day, and marathon TV shows in bed, I sat at my desk and worked. I tried to approach my teachers about doing the AP work, but it was difficult to talk to them. They were rarely in the classroom, and when they were, they acted like they couldn't wait to leave. I finally managed to corner my geology teacher about it, but she'd just blinked at me when I brought up working on my AP bio textbook instead and said that I should ask Dr. Behrens at my next appointment. I didn't tell my parents, though. I lied that it had been no problem and I was keeping up easily. I didn't want them to worry about it, not when they already had so much else to stress about. I woke up early to shower and I stayed up late to study, and by the weekend, it had paid off. I'd done a week's worth of the AP reading and assignments. Plus, I'd taken half of a practice SAT test, since I wanted at least a 30-point boost when I retook the test. On Friday afternoon, I was sitting in the library working on a practice SAT math section, even though I didn't feel that great. I was exhausted and had a slight fever, and my temples throbbed with a headache that wouldn't go away. The hall nurse had given me an aspirin, which was about as helpful as a pat on the back. I sighed and stared down at my workbook, trying to muster the energy to do another page, when all I wanted to do was put my head down on the table and sleep until dinner. Come on, I told myself, just five more. I'd worked through another two problems when the door to the library opened. Are you sure you have it? A girl whispered. God, Sadie, for the last time, yes, a boy whispered back. It was the four of them. Charlie in his Doc Martens and enormous DJ headphones, Marina wearing a funny old dress with billowing sleeves, and Nick and Sadie bickering. They'd brought their book bags even though it was Friday, even though classes had ended hours ago. A strange, illicit energy passed between them. I hadn't run into them in the library before, and I watched as Nick went to the librarian's desk to ask for an internet pass. There was a bank of old desktops in the back of the library, the one place at Latham where you could get online. You needed a pass, though, and even then, you could only use the internet for 30 minutes once a week. According to the handbook, internet access was stress-inducing and unnecessary. Nick chatted with the librarian, and instead of waiting for him, his friends split up, each of them sitting at a different table. That, by itself, was weird. Why go to the library with your friends if you're just going to sit by yourself? I was studying near the computer bank, and I couldn't help but watch as Nick sat down at one of the PCs. He opened his bag and took out a little box and some cables. An external hard drive, probably, which was smart. I tried to think if I still had my USB stick. But as Nick plugged it in, I realized it wasn't a hard drive. It was a router. And then I saw that girl Marina with her laptop open at one of the big tables. She was logging onto Facebook. I couldn't believe it. I got up and took a walk around the library, pretending to look for a book. Sure enough, Sadie had her computer out too, with noise-canceling headphones clamped over her ears. And Charlie was on his tablet. They had internet. All of them. Without using their passes. And I was beyond jealous. I could feel the librarian watching me like she thought I was going to shove a copy of Moby Dick down my pants. So I grabbed a random book and brought it back to my table, pretending that was what I'd wanted. I tried to turn my attention to my practice test, but it was no use. All I could think about was that router. I'd never wanted to be part of a group the way I did in that moment. They were out of sync with Latham House, but not in the same way that I was. They acted like we were at any old boarding school, where you rolled your eyes at the rules and snuck off to do what you wanted. And it wasn't just the internet. It was the way out of everyone. They seemed the least defeated, the least likely to give up and spend the day in bed feeling sorry for themselves. They weren't on vacation. They were off on an adventure. I wished I knew how to talk to them, but every time I saw them together, they seemed so unapproachable. Sadie, most of all. She'd seemed to hate me after I'd nearly impaled her with a cafeteria tray. I told myself that I didn't care. I wasn't at Latham to make friends, and I didn't plan on sticking around long enough to need them. Besides, I had work to do. I didn't have time for adventures. After a few minutes, a loud group of guys came in returning DVDs. There was some commotion with one of the cases having the wrong movie in it. "It was like that when I got it," a guy with a nasally voice complained. "Come on, let me check out another." "I'm sorry," the librarian said, "but you're at the limit. You need to return one before I can let you do that."
"I am returning one," the guy insisted.
"You need to return what you checked out," said the librarian.
"That's what I'm doing," the guy said. "Do I look like I don't a copy of Legally Blonde?"
His friends started laughing.
"Shut up," he said. "Someone probably switched the cases. Help me look."
The three of them sauntered over to the DVD section and started pulling out cases and opening them.
"Excuse me," the librarian shrilled. "You can't do that."
I could hear her heels clicking against the wood floor as she cut a swath through the library. And then it hit me. Sadie was sitting right near the DVD section. She wouldn't hear the librarian coming. Not with those headphones on. The librarian was going to catch Sadie on the internet. She was going to discover the router. I pushed back my chair and ran.
"Wait," I called. Librarian?
"Just a minute," she snapped.
"It's an emergency," I said desperately.
She turned. And I had nothing. I tried to think fast.
"A really big emergency," I repeated loudly.
I caught Sadie's attention, and her eyes went wide as she snapped her laptop shut. I stalled.
"There are ants all over the reference section. Someone spilled juice."
It was a lousy excuse, but too late to make up another one. The librarian muttered something under her breath and rushed in the other direction. I hurried back to my table to pack up because I didn't want to be there when she realized I'd lied. I was putting my calculator into my bag when a shadow fell over the table. It was Sadie. and she looked furious. "What are you doing?" she demanded. "Fleeing the scene of a crime?" I shouldered my backpack. "Colonel Mustard in the library with the ants." "That's not cute," Sadie said, following me out of the library. "Just in case you were wondering." I held the door open for her, and she shot me a look. "I didn't need your help." She folded her arms across her chest. "It looked like you did," I told her. "Well, I didn't."
"Okay,"
I shrugged. "Whatever." I started to head back toward the dorms, but Sadie followed me. "You're not going to tell anyone about the router, are you?" she asked. "Of course not," I said. The thought hadn't even occurred to me, but it had clearly occurred to Sadie. I waited for her to thank me or to say that I could join them the next time they pulled an internet heist, but she did neither of those things. And I was tired of her acting like I was this terrible person who needed to be taught a lesson. "What is it?" I asked. "Why do you have a problem with me?" Sadie laughed a little, like it was so obvious that she couldn't even believe I was asking. "Think back to summer camp," she prompted. "I didn't even know you. Then why did you ask me to the freaking dance?" She said it with such force and such anger that I took a step back. Her eyes were dark and her jaw jutted stubbornly, and I knew that whatever she was talking about was the real reason she'd been so awful to me ever since we'd run into each other at the tray return. "I never asked you to any dance," I said.
"Yes, you did," Sadie accused. "You wrote me a note and you gave me your sunglasses."
"My sunglasses?" I tried to think back, and then I realized they'd been stolen along with my headphones. These two guys in my cabin had gotten kicked out for it, too. They'd taken iPods, watches, even cash.
"I waited forever for you to pick me up for the dance," Sadie went on. "And then a girl came with that note saying you changed your mind."
"I've never written you a note in my life," I said, which was the truth. "Someone was messing with you, but it wasn't me." Sadie narrowed her eyes at me, like she wasn't sure what was true, and then she shook her head.
"I don't believe you."
"Do you remember the note? The writing?" I asked. She nodded. I pulled out my notebook with a flourish. "Well?" I demanded. One of the things about having a mom who taught third grade was that she drilled me on perfect penmanship. She'd made me practice in composition books after school, sitting next to her while she graded papers. I had hated it, but it had resulted in what Hannah called Lane sans serif. Sadie stared down at my notebook, her cheeks flushing an even brighter shade of pink.
"I have to go," she mumbled. "Thanks for the, diversion."
I really wasn't feeling that great, so I spent the rest of that night in bed. I told myself it was just a migraine, but I suppose on some level I knew the truth. I'd been overdoing it. Too much studying, not enough food, too little sleep. I'd managed it well enough at home, but that was before. Before my lungs turned traitor, and walking laps around the sports field in wellness made me so exhausted that I plonked face down on my mattress after it was over. I felt gross when I woke up the next morning. I was running a fever, which wasn't high enough to bother a nurse over, but still made getting out of bed feel like an ordeal. I lay there feeling sorry for myself until I barely had enough time to throw on a pair of shorts and make it to breakfast. Genevieve and John and their friend Angela were trying to sell me on their prayer group again, but I couldn't pay attention. My head throbbed, and my arms felt so rubbery that it was a miracle I hadn't dropped my tray in line. I felt like I'd pulled an all-nighter, even though I'd gone to sleep around 1.
"Well?" Genevieve asked, leaning toward me. "What do you think?"
I hadn't been listening. At all. I'd been watching Tim cut his pancake into tiny pieces and drop them into his cereal, which was so weird that at first I thought I must be imagining it.
"About what?" I asked. Angela sighed. And then I started coughing. I scrambled for my handkerchief, but I hadn't brought it, or that stupid biohazard baggie we were supposed to carry it in, so I grabbed a napkin instead. When I took it away from my mouth, it was stained with blood. My mouth tasted disgusting, and the whole table was staring at me uneasily. The blood thing freaked me out. It had happened twice before, right when I'd gotten sick, but not for weeks now. Shit, I said, balling up the napkin. Sorry.
Hey, everyone has bad days, John offered. It's no big deal if you can't make it to prayer group later.
Wow, thanks, I was really worried about that, I said. I knew I was being a dick, but I didn't care. I couldn't sit there and eat my breakfast while they stared at me with these worried looks on their faces, like my med sensor was about to start beeping. I'm not hungry, I said, picking up my tray. And then I went back to the dorm where, for the first time that wasn't 6 in the morning, both showers were free. I stood there for a long time in the lukewarm water, hoping it would bring down my fever, and trying not to panic over the indisputable evidence that I wasn't getting better at all, that, if anything, I was getting worse. Hannah called me that evening. I could hear the excitement in her voice as she asked if I'd gotten her email, and I told her I hadn't checked yet. Why not? She asked. Because the librarian hates me.
What did you do, study too loudly?
Hannah giggled like it was inconceivable that I could do anything to jeopardize my permanent status as teacher's pet. I sighed, not wanting to get into it. I'm not going back there, I insisted. I'll just give up the internet. I'll go outside or something. I heard there's this thing called the sun.
Overrated, Hannah said. Now go read my essay and call me back, please.
So I went. Thankfully, the librarian gave me an internet pass without even bothering to look up. I logged on, not knowing what to do first. Because it turns out, when time is precious, there isn't much of a point in reading webcomics or listicles. I didn't have anything important in my inbox apart from Hannah's essay, which I loaded onto my stick to read later. I had a couple of Facebook messages, mostly of the "How are things?" and "Get better soon" variety from classmates I'd barely ever talked to. And one glance at my wall was enough to thoroughly depress me. Everyone wanted me to know that I was in their thoughts and prayers, except for this kid from math class who was promoting his band's new EP. I loved that, how there was one guy who just wanted me to buy some music, who either didn't know or didn't care what was going on in my life. For the rest of the time, I clicked through my Facebook photos, trying to see what my life would look like to a total stranger. Most of the pictures were grainy cell phone things, other people's uploads from the Model UN conferences, featuring everyone in the van, in our suits around a conference table, wearing sweatshirts and an Applebee's at 1 in the morning somewhere near San Diego. I had my arm around Hannah in most of them. There were pictures from junior prom, too, of Hannah and me in our formal wear, our smiles ridiculously fake as we posed with the Paris-themed backdrop. From the pictures, you'd almost think I had a life beyond making the honor roll. After my internet session expired, I walked back to the cottages. It was around 8 o'clock and one of the Indiana Jones movies was being screened in the gym. Genevieve and Angela hadn't shut up about it at dinner. Apparently, everyone brought blankets and pillows and came in their pajamas. But it seemed like the kind of thing that was only good if you had the right people to go with. It was eerily quiet outside, and the birch trees behind the dining hall rose straight and white in the distance. I hadn't spent a lot of time outside lately, and I'd forgotten how peaceful it was to be alone in the dark. I walked slowly, breathing in the cool air, and it made the ache in my chest a little better. I could feel the USB stick in my pocket, and I wondered what Hannah had written for her essay. Maybe about how she wanted to work as a White House staffer, or how she'd moved from Canada when she was 15. I had no idea what I was going to do for mine. When I got back to Cottage 6, I went up to my room and plugged my USB stick into my laptop. There was this awful moment where I thought the file hadn't transferred, and then it opened. L. Thanks for proofing. She'd put at the top. You're a rock star. Smiley face. It was the smiley face that made me totally unprepared for what she'd written. At first, I thought it was a joke. Then I was confused, and then I was angry as all hell. The essay was about me, about how we'd planned to go to college together, but after I'd become terminally ill, she knew that she needed to live for the both of us. She actually said that. Live for the both of us. Like I was too corpsified to do any living for myself. Like TB was a guaranteed death sentence, and the bedsheet was already being pulled over my head. It wasn't a college essay. It was an obituary. My obituary. My phone rang, startling me. I knew it was Hannah, and I knew that whatever I said to her right now would be unforgivable. But I also knew that I didn't give a shit. Hi, I said flatly. Did you read it? Hannah asked. Yeah. And? Honestly, I'm in shock, I said. Well, it's a bit embellished for dramatic effect, Hannah allowed. Wow, you think? I said, my anger flaring. Was the essay prompt to write an obituary for someone you know? I thought you'd be flattered, Hannah said. Flattered? That I, how did you put it? Was grateful for the days you sat by my hospital bed, helping me through the pain? It was quiet on her end of the line, but I could still hear her there, pop music playing softly in the background. I wasn't trying to exploit you, she said. Your words, not mine. Lane, no, I said. I don't care, and I don't want to hear it, because the thing is, I'm not dead. I'm not dying. And here's another thing I'm not, while we're at it. I'm not your boyfriend anymore. I slammed down the phone, which was oddly satisfying. Much more than stabbing angrily at the screen of my iPhone. I kept repeating what I'd said to her over and over again in my head. That I wasn't dead, and I wasn't dying, no matter what Hannah had written in her essay. The odds were 80% that I'd walk out of Latham before the end of the year with an arrested case of TB and a doctor's note permanently excusing me from gym class. I thought Hannah knew that, or at least that she understood the difference between terminal and incurable. I thought she understood a lot of things, and I thought I had too. I'd been so stupid. It was never going to work out with Hannah and me. Staying together while I went off to Latham was a joke. We'd been humoring each other, but it wasn't funny anymore. I didn't know if she'd sent me that essay because it said what she was afraid to tell me, that she wanted to move on, or if she genuinely wanted me to have it, like some fucked up tribute. At least I got some small satisfaction from knowing how awkward it would be for her when I returned to Harbor and to her classes, and when she saw me around campus at Stanford, if she even got in. I hope that sob story of an essay ruined her chances. I'd done so much of her English homework, come up with her essay topics, helped her put together the outlines, proofed every one of her papers, even the 2-page weekly responses. I'd carried us through physics for the entire thermodynamics unit because she was too stressed over the SATs to prep for labs. And I hadn't minded. I'd been happy to help, because it meant I had someone to spend time with instead of studying alone in my room. Instead of being the guy everyone hesitated over before inviting me to things, because no one really wanted to hang out with their hard-ass history teacher's kid, I read her essay one more time, just in case I'd overreacted, just to make sure it really was as bad as all that. It was worse. I took the stairs down to the common room and let myself out of the dorm. It was cool outside. The whole world vibrating with the low hum of crickets. Or maybe cicadas. I could never tell the difference. I stood there for a minute, not knowing what to do or where to go. Latham still felt so wrong, like I was living someone else's life, because this couldn't be mine. I could see the gazebo in the distance, so I walked out there through the wet grass and sat on the steps,
feeling totally out of sync with the universe. I stared up at the stars, which were dead things, and the trees, which were silent and ghostly, but alive. And I tried not to think about what Hannah had written in her essay. I didn't cry, because I was scared that if I started, I'd never stop. I could feel everything straining inside of me, like strings stretched so tightly that maybe it wasn't the crickets that were humming at all. Maybe it was me. After a while, there was a rustling in the woods, the sound of footsteps. I glanced up, wondering who else would be outside. I could just make out the shadow of a girl. She crept across the grass with a heavy backpack, a knit cap on her head. And then she stopped, staring at me.
Lane?
Asked Sadie.
Chapter 8. Sadie. I hated when Nick didn't come with me, and he hadn't that night. He'd backed out at the last minute, claiming he was